Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. In the Catholic world, a synod is a big deal. Such a meeting among diocesan leaders and others to discuss possible changes to church doctrine is not taken lightly. And now the Bishop of Vermont's Roman Catholic Diocese has announced plans to convene the first synod since 1962. Bishop Christopher Coyne of Burlington has called this a serious undertaking by the church, adding that it's not just a simple convening of meetings. Bishop Coyne joins me today in our VPR studios to tell us more about what the church hopes to accomplish with this synod. Bishop Coyne, thank you so much for being with us today.
And thank you for having me, Mitch.
So, Bishop Coyne, let's start with sort of the particulars here. A synod, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's a convening of church officials, both current and ex officio members, but there is participation beyond those involved in official church doctrine. Is that right?
Correct. If a bishop calls for a diocesan synod, there are particular guidelines that come out of Rome as to how it is to be carried out. And there are men and women who are ex officio members of the synod as delegates. Along with that, you have members from the clergy, the presbyteral council are ex officio, as well as laymen and laywomen from the diocesan pastoral council, which is made up of about 30 men and women chosen from around the state that I meet with quarterly already. I invited all of them to participate. And then I encouraged each parish to name a delegate. So we met for our first time at a preparatory meeting on Saturday, and we had over 100 people in downtown Burlington on a Saturday. And we began the work of preparing for the actual synod itself, which we hope to have take place in October.
And this is pretty much a year-long project. Is that right, how you envision it?
Yeah. Specifically because I want to have conversation. I don't want to just impose things from on high. But I want to hear from the people that are in the pews, the people that aren't in the pews, as to where we are, where we're going, what we could do better, what we're not doing, and then begin to kind of strategize as to how best we move forward in the years to come with a kind of pastoral plan for addressing the needs of the church and addressing the needs of the communities in which we live.
Why do this now? As we've said, this is the first synod since 1962. That's a long time between them. Why do you feel this is so important to do now?
Sure. It's a big undertaking, first of all, and it's not something that you want to undertake lightly. And so if you call synods every 3 or 4 years, it doesn't quite have the momentous occasion or the sense of something important taking place. So they don't tend to happen all that often within the life of a diocese. But when the last synod took place in 1962, the Catholic Church, for good or for bad, was at the height of its influence and the height of its strength. The churches were full. Our schools were full. There were vocations, many vocations. The churches of Vermont, whether it's the Catholic Church or the ecumenical churches or the temples and others, were part of the culture. And they were seen to be not as something separate from the mainstream culture, but something to be completely immersed in the culture.
Which surprises me that you would then call a synod under those conditions. You kind of feel like, if it ain't broke, why fix it?
Yeah, and when you go back and you look – it was an interesting endeavor. When you go back and you look at what actually came out of the 62 synod, there are some good things, but there are some particulars that are just kind of head-shaking. You know, how priests are to dress, can they own a car, things about nuns, all that. And we're not getting into that at all.
Right.
The reason why I've called it now is because the ground has shifted in it. We've changed in such an incredible way right now. We're no longer a mainstream church. We're the church on the outside. That's a challenge. We're not part of the mainstream culture in that we're considered to be a kind of conversation partner when government policy or city policy is undertaken. In fact, if we try and get involved in some of these matters, whether it's in the central government, state government, or other, we're kind of told, you know, separation of church and state, Father Bishop, you need to kind of stay away from this. So we're a missionary church now. We're looking at a community that in many ways is post-Christian. More than 40% of the people in Vermont self-identify as non-religious. And those that say they're religious, you have to kind of unpack that and figure out what they're doing. We're down to about 20% of the state identifies as Catholic, but only that's about 120,000 Catholics, but only about 30,000 are actually active. So we can't keep doing things the way we've been doing. We want to be a church that speaks the truth of who we are. We want to encourage people to be part of what we have and beautiful faith that we have. But we also want to be partners within the general culture of the state. We want to serve the common good. We want to be seen as something – as people who are serious that have something to say. So my hope is that we can engage in a conversation as a church first so that we can not only begin to move forward, but we can then begin to engage the culture in a meaningful way.
It occurs to me that the church has some of the same problems that the state of Vermont has, and namely among them retaining young people and their interest in the church. If you're going to have a future, you've got to have young people, perhaps millennials, be involved in church life now. Is that another reason to call this in?
It certainly is. There was a study that came out about 5 years ago, and it's been an ongoing study out of Notre Dame, and the name of the the book is Young Catholic Adults, Going, Gone from the Church. And what they did was they studied kids when they were 15, 16 who came from what you would call good Catholic families, active. The families did a lot of things in the church. They involved the parish council. The kids went to Catholic school, all those things that you would identify as good Catholics. And then they followed them as they progressed into adulthood until they became 27, 28. Of those 500 or 600 students that they followed, only 17% of them have anything to do with the church. And we're talking families that were active, not the inactive families. So we have a real – it's not just that people – the young people are not staying in Vermont. It's that the young people who stay in Vermont aren't hearing our message in a positive way so that they would like to be part of what we are. But the demographic reality is really a strong one too that we face.
We do have a lot of interest in this. In fact, let's go to the phones. Alfonso is on the line from South Burlington. Hi, Alfonso.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I come from South Florida. I'm 28. I grew up in the church. My parents were Catholic, and I was very grateful for that upbringing. Coming to Vermont, I shopped around. I tried going to several parishes, and my experience overall is that it's not entirely welcoming. There's a lot of fire and brimstone in the homilies, and I wish that there would be a retooling of how priests approach their homilies. Sometimes they're too cerebral, and they focus too much on what it's almost as if you're in class for the liturgy, and I wish it was a little bit more about their personal experiences, what they did to engage with the liturgy and engage with the community and to inspire and welcome people.
Alfonso, how old are you?
I'm 28.
Okay. Thanks very much for that call. I appreciate it. Well, there we've got a young caller who's talking about the church sounding maybe a little bit too fire and brimstone, a little too formal, not enough participation. What do you think about what Alfonso said there?
I absolutely hear what he's saying, and I agree with him on so many levels. It's not just a problem that we face with young people like Alfonso, and I thank him for his call and his honest comments, but that many of the members who were Catholic who have left the church have gone and joined the mega churches, the evangelical churches. In fact, the largest group in the United States of recognized, organized religious is Catholics, followed by ex-Catholics. And the ex-Catholics tend to not necessarily leave religion in a whole, but they go and find a place that serves their spiritual needs, their personal needs, their communal needs. When they go to the mega churches, they say the first thing that they felt was welcome. That when they walked through the door of the church, people made them feel welcome. They asked them who they were. They asked them where they came from. They introduced themselves. And I've been, I can tell you, I've gone into churches without a collar on, and you would have thought that I was an invisible man, and this is Catholic churches. So I've been encouraging our churches now to consider, first of all, when someone comes through the door of our church, do they feel welcome? And the second thing is, we had a years-long project with the priest to engage the question of preaching and homilies, exactly focusing on what Alfonso was saying. Old habits are hard to break, but we're making some headway. So I'm trying to do the best I can.
We got this from Mark, who said, if you want to engage younger people and attract more families to the church, then you have to engage them with people of their own age. I honestly don't believe that a priest my grandparents' age is going to connect with young people easily. This hints at the larger issue facing the Catholic Church, Mark writes. There is simply not enough people going into the priesthood, and their clergy are getting really old and dying off. Women priests and married priests would likely solve this problem but I imagine I will be dead before this happens. That's pretty much laying it on the line.
Sure. Well, we have married priests within the Catholic tradition. There's the Eastern Rite Catholics that are married, but we also have some Anglican priests and Episcopal priests who have come over into the Catholic Church who were previously married. Marriage, a married clergy, is not a matter of doctrine. It's just been a matter of practice. It's been a matter of tradition within the Latin Rite Church. So I wouldn't be opposed to the idea of having a married clergy or having clergy who are married. It's going to be – if you do that, it's real challenges though because you have to give them a just wage. You have to worry about their children going to college, all those things. And you know, Catholics are very generous at times, but when you start calling – when you start talking about the ballot – not the ballot box, the collection basket, it gets like a little bit of a third rail.
Although those mega churches don't seem to be shy about passing around the hat, do they?
No, they're not. And you know what is interesting about them is they have clear expectations. They say, we want you to be part of our church, but this is what's expected of you, that you will be here on Sunday, that you will support the church financially by tithing, that you will undertake some kind of social mission, that you will be part of a Bible study group. Those clear expectations are good for people who are looking for some kind of direction in their lives. They know what they're being asked. In Catholicism, we don't do that. We know, we talk about it. It's in the catechism. You know, we kind of say this is what – everybody knows what you should be doing, but we don't say – we don't enumerate it. And I think if we gave more clear expectations to people, I think that they would respond positively in a way that we haven't challenged them.
Let's go back to the phones. Carol is on the line from Jamaica. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Hi, Bishop. My question is regarding the Vermont Crucio movement, a diocesan movement, and what you think its future might be going forward. And I shall listen off the air. I'm a parishioner at Our Lady of the Valley, where Father Fred is, by the way, a wonderful homilist, and Alfonso might come down here and listen to him. Thank you.
It's a little challenge from South Burlington to get down there. But and also, I have to tell you, I'm jealous that you're in Jamaica while the snowfall's coming down up here. The Crucio movement is still active, and I've been approached by the leadership of the Crucio to support it, and I do support it. But I can honestly, I haven't really been that engaged with it, and not because I don't want to be, but because I just haven't followed through. So I think that that's a good thing for me to hear, and I promise to follow through with them and see what they need to continue to flourish.
Carmen is on the line from Burlington. Hi, Carmen.
I just wanted to say thank you, Bishop Coyne, for being open and really looking for the ways to connect with people. I've had many bad experiences with the Catholic Church, and I think the last straw for me was the letter that was read just before the presidential election, which was read by our priest, wonderful priest, and directed us to vote for the person who was pro-life over any other issue. And I walked out of the church and I haven't returned. I couldn't believe that the church would tell me to vote for Trump, which is he was the only pro-life presidential candidate. And now that we see with all the hindsight what was possible from him, I just wanted to say I'm really glad to hear that you're talking about not being political. So that's one thing I just really want to make clear that there was another woman who walked out that day too. So the other thing when it comes to that I wanted to share is that I feel like the Sisters of Mercy are really the people who you should be talking to. They're, if you aren't already, they're the ones who really inspire me to want to be Catholic or Christian, you know. So I'll just listen to what you have to say, and thank you so much for having this dialogue.
Carmen, thank you very much for that call. I appreciate that. She brings up a really important issue here, I think, Bishop Coyne, and that is one about the church being political. On the one hand, it's fairly well known how the Catholic Church feels officially about things like abortion. But to come out and to influence someone to say to vote for a certain candidate or another, how do you separate that? Can it be separated?
Sure. We can't legally get up in the pulpit or even through our publications say you are to vote for this particular candidate and not that one. That's not what is allowed by nonprofit organizations.
And yet this seems to have happened in this case.
Now, I'm puzzled by that because if she's referring to the letter that I read, I went out of my way to make sure that that was not intended to be communicated. Perhaps the priest added his own commentary to it. I don't know, and I'm not challenging the listener at all. Sometimes, I think I've crafted a good letter and then it's heard and people hear a whole different thing. I really go out of my way to avoid politics as much as possible. I'm a pastor, not a politician. I simply state the church's teaching in these various matters and allow people of goodwill to discern their own way in these matters. I would never have – I'm sorry that was heard that way because I would never have intended people to say you have to vote only if they're pro-choice. Although I would like, obviously to have more pro-life people out there. But that having been said, sometimes the message gets lost and I think I'm saying the right thing but I don't explain the right thing. I appreciate that. And the Sisters of Mercy, they're wonderful. They're very supportive. I see them in and about town. They have a lot of good works that they're doing. We've tried to engage them in various endeavors. They're stretched in to their communities getting old and the sisters that are younger are taking on a lot of responsibility. So they're already got a lot of things that they're working at. And so I just try and support it, but I don't really ask them to do anything more because I don't want to burden them. And the few times I've asked them, they'd say, Bishop, we just can't help you because we're already stretched.
I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. The Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington has called a synod for the first time since 1962, and we've been hearing from Bishop Christopher Coyne about why he thinks now is the right time for a synod more than 50 years since the last one, and about what the Church hopes to learn from this council. Bishop Coyne is remaining with us here in the studios, and right now we're going to a group that's been calling for a synod in Vermont. It's the Concerned Catholics of Vermont, and Dennis O'Brien is a member of that group. He joins us now on the line. Dennis, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Mitch. We have been in existence for about 8 or 9 years. We have people from all over the state, largely an internet community, though we've had some general meetings at Weston Priory and other places throughout the state. We have been pressing for a synod for precisely the reason that the bishop indicated, that obviously the culture has changed since 1962 and that the threats to the future of the church in Vermont and, in fact, to other religious communities in Vermont is significant, simply because we don't have enough priests. In our case, we're losing young people and so on. And it was our feeling that that had to be addressed. It couldn't just be let slide. And so we were delighted when we met with the bishop early when he was first here and suggested a synod. And he said, well, I want to get to know the state first by going around and talking to people. And so we were delighted when after 2 or 3 years he announced that indeed we were going to have a synod. And we're very happy about that.
Well, Dennis, what is your group, the Concerned Catholics of Vermont, feel are the biggest, most important issues that need to be addressed at this synod?
Well, I think that we have a number of different sorts of views about things. If I had to sum something up, and I think it's important, the bishop was introduced about this is a change of doctrine. I don't believe the synod is going to change any doctrines. That's not something that the Catholic Church does very often, and if it does it, it doesn't usually do it at the local level. What it does seem to me is it's going to change a sense of the way the church exists in the society. And our group, I think, is heavily committed to the kind of vision that Pope Francis has, that the church is a field hospital. The church I grew up with in Chicago in the good old days was not seen as a field hospital. It was seen as a fortress. We knew everything, and we were there to protect ourselves. I don't think we are so sure now that we know everything, and we certainly know that we cannot take a defensive position. We have to be open. We have to listen to people. We have to do exactly what the Pope says, and that is to be a field hospital. A field hospital is something that services the spiritual illnesses of the time, and whether you're a member of the Catholic Church or the Jewish community or non-religious or whatever, if you don't think that there are spiritual ills at the present time in our country that need to be addressed, I think you've missed the boat. And so I think the church has much to contribute to that. And I think what we would like to see come out of the synod more than any specific ideas, and we have a number of them, would be how is the sense of the church? How is the church going to approach its task? And I says, I say, we favor the way in which Pope Francis wants to do that as a listening pastoral church, and I think that's what the bishop wants to do too.
Well, Dennis, given that you said, and Bishop Coyne was telling me the very same thing off the air, that you know no doctrine is likely to be actually changed over this. It's
right.
Not as though the Pope is going to find out what happened here in Vermont and said, okay, you know, the Vermont Diocese has said we need to change this. It's going to happen. Would you consider participation during this process to be the most critical thing? In other words, how many people come to listen, what their age group is, getting people involved. Because if you go and have this synod and it's just familiar faces that you maybe see every Sunday, that's probably not going to widen this tent, if you will.
Well, that's a problem. But I must say, being a participant personally on the Diocesan Pastoral Council, and also attending the synodal meeting, which was held on Saturday last, I'm rather encouraged by the kind of enthusiasm and willingness to pitch in which people have. We're going to have the same problem, and the bishop knows that very well, of making sure that the folks who show up for all these meetings are not gray hairs. But again, on both cases, I've been pleased to see that there are the very, very young are a difficult group to bring in, but I think we're getting a greater representation of Catholics than I would have thought it would be the case. Now, to transfer that enthusiasm back down to the parish level and to the people who are in the parish, one of the things you have to do is exactly what the bishop said. When you show up at the church, people got to know your name.
Yeah, got to welcome them in. Dennis O'Brien, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Mitch.
Concerned Catholics of Vermont is the group Dennis was talking about. Bishop Coyne, you heard Dennis there talking about getting people involved. He seems to be, I'd say, optimistic about things. Have you seen the same kind of enthusiasm that Dennis is talking about so far?
I have. I think in many ways we're beginning to, as Catholics say, you know, we're not going to retreat anymore. We're not going to apologize anymore. This is who we are. This is the good that we can bring to society. This is the good that we can bring to the individuals in terms of our faith. And to speak positively about what we're for rather than what we're against, and to not allow ourselves to be defined by what we're against is an important thing. I think my encouragement to people is we have to walk with them. We have to invite. We have to be merciful people, as Dennis said. And when that person comes through the door, they're not just an opportunity. They're our brother and our sister.
Okay. I've got to bring up something here because I imagine that some people listening to this have been wondering why we haven't talked about it to this point. And this is certainly something that has been a problem for the Catholic Church for a while now. Joyce in Burlington emailed us and said, as a millennial who was raised Catholic, I had to write in today. I was raised in a Catholic family, attended Catholic schools, and had many profound and beautiful religious experiences as a child. But as I reached adulthood and learned about the Catholic Church's systemic cover-ups of decades of child abuse and continue to see church officials, including Pope Francis, deny or shrug off these charges, I grew beyond disillusioned. In fact, I now realize, Joyce writes, that I was seriously traumatized by the patriarchal, hierarchical, and misogynistic culture of the Catholic Church I grew up in. First time I attended a Mass at an Episcopal church where love, tolerance, and hope were preached by a female priest, I burst into tears. To me, the Catholic Church's current status quo is harmful and anachronistic at best. Now, isn't Joyce exactly the kind of young Catholic the Church needs to retain? And how can the Church do so, given her concerns that she laid out here?
Yeah, you know, she's not alone. She's not sharing something with me and others that we all haven't heard. The clergy abuse crisis and the cover-up that was involved was an evil that destroyed not only children and families but also destroyed the kind of trust that people had in the Catholic community and in the Catholic faith and in the Catholic clergy. And we cannot stop. We have to apologize over and over again and do everything that we can to make things better. Pope Francis' recent comments when he was down in Chile were very unfortunate. I don't know where they came from because that's never been his style before. I'm not going to make excuses for him by saying that maybe he was tired. He's an 83-year-old man, you know, who just lost his temper because he – I don't know. But
I'm going to have to just insert here, and I'll let you continue, but we should let people know that may not be aware of what happened recently with Pope Francis. He criticized the victims of Chilean priest Fernando Caradima for claiming that his bishop knew of his predatory behavior and yet refused to act on the information. And Pope Francis said, quote, you in all goodwill tell me that there are victims, but I have not seen any because they haven't come forward. So I think you're referring to those particular comments.
Yeah, it was when the bishop was a priest and this priest abuser was one of his friends. And the claim that's being made is that he should have known or he did know that this guy was an abuser. And then when he was named a bishop, the people immediately came forward and said he knew. And, you know, hindsight maybe I'm not going to go into like second-guessing whether he should have been named a bishop, but it's caused all kinds of problems down in Chile. And I was as puzzled as anybody else by the Pope's response when he lost his temper and told him that they didn't have any proof that the bishop when he was a priest actually knew. So again, the proper response is to just listen. You know, these victims were not heard. They felt for years that they were never heard. And when we say something to anybody that says, I'm not listening to you because I don't believe you, that's sending the wrong message. We have to listen, even if sometimes it's a little dubious as to what they actually happened or what actually said, because for years they weren't heard.
We do have more people wanting to speak about these issues. Let's go to Miriam in South Burlington. Hi, Miriam. You're on Vermont Edition.
Hello.
Hello. Yes. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that in order to create a community, you have to make it available. You can say create community, but if you don't, if you don't encourage it, if you don't have discussion groups, or even I grew up during the 70s and I would go to the socials that the church would put together, dancing and, you know, so to bring people together to create a community, then we have to do, and not the same people, but different people like millennials. And then also the other point was that just discuss, talk about the sacraments, you know, just talk about the mysteries, you know, talk about these things that, you know, pique the young people's curiosity. Talk about the mythology behind the religion, the mystical aspect of it. You know, I think that opening that discussion will encourage more people to come, that it's just not the priest up there doing his thing, his ritual,
right,
but that what's behind it, what's in front of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Miriam, thank you very much for that call. And that's an interesting point that Miriam raises, Bishop Coyne, about one of the things that, you know, and I'm Jewish, I'm not Catholic, but I have always been amazed by what she was talking about, the mysticism. You walk into a church, you see an amazingly ornate, beautiful place with candles and the stained glass. And when you get into that side of it, sort of the mystical part of it, the spiritual part of it, I know that may not be directly related to the Word of God, but isn't that something that could draw in young people?
I think Miriam's hit on a couple of good points, and let me just address yours with hers as well. I think when we do our rituals well in our churches, they evoke a kind of deep sense of meaning and depth that goes beyond the words that are spoken or the gestures that are done. People who work with men and women who are coming into the church to become Catholics will often tell you that that person experienced a profound moment of spiritual change when they were attending a Catholic funeral or a Catholic wedding that was done well. So the encouragement for me to my priests is, you know, do what we do well. Do what it says, what the church asks us to do, and do it well, because that's going to lead people deeper into the mystery of faith. The second thing was the first part she talked about, and that's like, you know, we need to have more groups and other things like that. Well, I hope we can, but that was the paradigm that we had for years. You know, you had all these clubs and these groups and everything, and you opened the doors and people came. Well, they're not coming, you know, and that's just not Catholic. That's culturally. The book Bowling Alone, which came out about 10 years ago, and other studies. Men and women of this generation in this culture aren't joining clubs.
Civic engagement.
Rotary clubs.
Yep. It's not just religious.
You know, and there's all kinds of studies and reasons for that. And so we have to confront that same dynamic as any other group. So we can have these groups, but they don't come.
David is on the line with us from St. Albans. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hello. Go right ahead.
Hello?
Yep, you're on the air,
yes.
David. Yep.
Yes, my question for Bishop Chris Coyne is that a paramount concern of Vermont Catholics is the process in deciding what parishes – or churches are to be closed. And, you know, many have been closed already on my watch, and I'm 55 years old. And, you know, I just, it seems like they always close, you know, an inner-city church, and they leave these suburban, newer churches open. And, you know, I St. Albans, St. Mary's Parish, where I belong and attend, you know, that's the oldest surviving Catholic church in the state. And, you know, they have a newer church, the Ascension Church in Georgia, Vermont, which, you know, is a small new church, modern. I'm sure it's energy efficient and, you know, big parking lot and right off the interstate exit. But why would you, you know, I mean, it just seems like, you know, they might make the decision to keep the Georgia one up because there's a lot of new housing in Georgia, but they would close either, you know, Holy Angels or St. Mary's, which is a combined parish. So I'll take my answer offline.
Okay, thanks, David.
Anytime you close a parish, you're causing a death of a community, the death of a family, and people will do everything they can to try and hold on at the end. You can give them all kinds of rational reasons for why a parish should be suppressed and closed, but they're going to struggle with that. You know, no one wants to close churches, but there's been so many demographic shifts within the state. Churches back in the mid-century, 1930s, 1940s, 1920s, were constructed so that families only had to make a horse and buggy ride in the morning to get to church and then get home for Sunday dinner. So, you know, it was done in such a way to feed that demographic, you know, that it was a small county church with big families and they could just sustain it. The issue that we're facing now is that many of those churches aren't – they're in population counties where there's nobody there. And they're not sustainable, not because we don't want to sustain them, but because there's nobody there.
The numbers don't work out.
The numbers don't work out. Whereas the larger churches of which David spoke, I think it was Nimbus, those are the ones where the people are. And so you wouldn't close those, but you're faced with kind of a radical shift in demographics within the state, as well as a radical shift in people who belong to the church.
We got this comment from Caitlin, who posted, as the pastor of Richmond Congregational Church in Richmond, I value the ways my congregation has held ecumenical Thanksgiving services with Holy Rosary Catholic Church in Richmond. She would encourage more ecumenical efforts around shared mission and social justice concerns. I want to ask to Bishop Coyne about, you know, you're talking here about the population shifts and whether smaller churches can really survive and whatnot. But it seems to me this synod has got to come up with some kind of positive vision for the future. In the few seconds we have left here, do you see that happening?
I absolutely. I try and speak positively as much as I can. I try to speak positively to the people that are in the church. They're there when they don't have to be there. I speak positively to the people who are starting to think about coming into the church. And I think we have such a vision and such meaning to bring to people who are seeking spiritual direction, who are speaking meaning in their life, that we can do it because we have the gift of faith that was given to us centuries ago by Jesus Christ.
So there are problems here, but opportunities as well.
Absolutely.
As you see them. Christopher Coyne, the Bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington, I want to thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.